Alan Kring Productions presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 4 for Spring Semester 2018. Lecture 23, delivered on April 18, 2018. The title of this lecture is Maintaining Optimal Capital Structure.
Today, capital structure and optimal capital financing. Now, before we begin the lecture today, just a quick look at the markets to see how things are going and all of that. Okay, beginning. Sir, good day, bad day? Meh. Nah, that's exactly right. It was a floater of a day, primarily because there wasn't any new news or expectations. We're in a holding pattern right now, waiting for the next good news or bad news. A few days ago, we impounded some pretty severely bad news when China announced 179% tariffs on our exports to China of sorghum. And China is showing that it knows right where to hit us in the literal breadbasket. Our agricultural sector is taking a hard brunt of the shots that China is firing back at us. But that was already impounded. So that's old news. That's already there. You can't profit from old news. And right now, we don't see anything new. There's a lot of volatility. There's no question that the market is highly volatile, which represents, of course, uncertainty. And there are some traders who just love volatility. But the professional investor, the moderate, just does not care for this volatility. It's scary. Volatility implies risk. Risk implies higher yields, which tend to put business on the defensive and pull in its horns. So, but I do want to make sure you see here, interestingly, if I look at the three indices as they track today, you notice that at the end of the day, there was a sell-off. There was a steep sell-off at the beginning, and then the bulls came back, but at the end, there was this sell-off, of course, that late-day trading volume pop. And if you that was the S&P 500. If we look at the Dow, you'll see that same steep sell-off. The markets were working together. They seemed to be all concerned about the same things. And you saw, again, that sell-off at the end. And then the NASDAQ, same story. That sell-off there at the end, the steep drop at the beginning, and the bulls rallied, and then it was a sell-off at the end. Now, you have to look at overnight trading, especially on the futures markets for these indexes, to see what's going to happen tomorrow. But this does not bode well here. It looks like we are going to have a down day tomorrow. Perhaps not so dramatic unless there's news overnight of something, of some new drama. But for right now, it looks like the markets are setting up for an opening that will be a bear market. How it proceeds for the rest of the day, who knows? But now, taking it away from that, we'll look at the yield curve here. Do you recall from perhaps last week where the spread was between the 7 and the 10-year? Do you recall, I mean from Monday, five basis points spread. It had gone from 7 down to 6, floating. Then it floated down and was at 5. Like I said, it frustrating. So now let's have a look at where we are tonight. This is the 7. Really? What am I looking at? The 7 and the 10, those two right there. What's the spread now? We see 4. Slowly creeping toward the inversion. As I said, it drives you crazy. It's taking its own sweet time, like I've seen it in the past do. But there is definitely a trend toward the inversion. It's not inverted. Go.
So we've been talking every week about this inversion that it seems like it's trending towards. What would it take for the trend to reverse?
An act of God. Really, at this point, you can't say inversion is going to happen, recession. You can't do that. That's irresponsible. But it would truly be something amazing. A report that said that all that we've seen building over the past months was wrong and that everything was far better than all of the numbers have been trending to show us. It would have to be more than one thing. Now, one thing might make everyone excited for a day, but it would have to be a consistent across other measures, manufacturing activity, consumer spending, consumer incomes, business earnings. They would all have to show something that we had not seen, and they'd all have to show it together, coordinated, for the trend to reverse. It's almost inevitable, but it's not absolutely, and I wouldn't call a recession until I see the inversion. We're close, but I want to call it, but I'm not going to until I see the technical inversion.
So because we've got a cyclical market, we're simply just due for a recession?
No, we're not due for, there's really no such thing as being due for a recession. We are headed for a recession. We have ourselves to blame for it. There is a business cycle. We don't fully understand all of why business cycles happen. We've understood it for centuries that there's a business cycle. As a matter of fact, even in the seminal works of Karl Marx on communism, he said there is a cycle in capitalism. He wrote a rather powerful explanation of it, which is rejected by capitalists in general. But he probably provided one of the strongest explanations of the factors that cause this cycle. And his prediction was that it would get worse and worse. There would be these ebbs and flows, but sometimes the ebbs would be stronger than you'd ever seen them before, and ultimately the system would collapse into a revolution. That was his take on it. Whether or not that is true, he certainly gave a compelling in Das Kapital. He gave a reasonably... probably one of the best explanations of why the business cycle happens. It's not that we're due for it. In his words, it was an inevitability of capitalism. Don't know. I'm not going to preach communism to you here because I've done that in the past. I have a lecture. If you ever want to learn about the details of a summary, a very strong, loud lecture, you can find on YouTube. I gave a lecture several years ago. Radical Economics of the Left. And it starts out kind of slow, teaching you the background of capitalist economics and finance, and then it goes into a ranting rage by the end. And I don't do that here because I do like the job. And that would be a bad idea. But anyway, moving away from that a little bit and going to the topic of interest today, that capital structure. Now, I did that thing with, well, we finance with equity, and we can finance capital projects with debt. But it's a little more detailed than that. You see, because there is a first place where a company should get money for spending. That first place isn't a stock offering or a borrowing of from bond buyers. The first place you would want to get money is from your earnings. If you can't sustain yourself with profit, then with free cash flow, as we would say, well, you shouldn't be in business. So in other words, the very first place a company should reach for money for capital projects is into its earnings after dividends. You pay out your dividend if you have that. And then what's left, that's available for capital projects. And over a long haul, you should certainly be used at having some earnings. Now, we call this, the technical term for this, because these earnings belong to the shareholders, the residual claim on the cash flows of a corporation, as I said, we call this internally generated equity. This is the money that belongs to the shareholders that we use on their behalf. We give them dividends, and then the rest of it we should be putting into projects. Now, the cost of this, if you'll recall, and I'll designate this as R sub E, the cost of this kind of capital was D1, the dividend one period out, over the price right now of the stock, plus the growth rate of the dividend. Now, this, of course, applies only if the company is paying a dividend and has a stable, regular dividend. It gets more complicated when we have to deal with companies that aren't dividend payers yet. But this is expensive. And that D1 is a dividend one period out. It's D0 times 1 plus G. But that number can be up there. I mean, 7... 10, 23, I've calculated cost of equity at 30% in some cases. But only after you've burned through the earnings on capital projects should you be going out and selling stock in stock offerings. We call that externally generated equity. You're getting money externally from new owners. Now, the cost of this, I designate this as R sub N. N for new equity. It's actually more expensive than your existing equity. Because this price zero here, that's the price of existing shareholders. But if you are selling new stock, it's D1 over P0 minus the float cost, how much you have to give the sellers of the stock, plus G. So in other words, if you got a $50 a share stock, the denominator for the cost of equity would be $50. But if I have to sell stock to new owners like you, ma'am, you're the investment banker, she's going to pay $50 to you, you're going to take $5 or $6 or $8. And so it's going to be $50 minus $5, $6, or $8. So that gets more expensive. You notice that this one, with that minus flotation cost, the denominator is smaller, which makes the whole ratio larger, plus the G. So yeah, that can be expensive. It's even more expensive than equity, than internally generated equity. And then, of course, you have your debt. Now, the cost of debt, R sub D, after taxes, is your current yield to maturity, R sub D, times 1 minus your tax rate, because you get to deduct the interest expense on borrowed money from your taxable income. This tends to make debt quite cheap for a while. Once you borrow too much, then you start paying higher and higher interest rates, and then that's when equity begins to get to be attractive. Because the debt can, when the bankers say, oh, you've borrowed so much, we are going to jack up the interest rate we charge you to the point where it'll make your nose bleed. Hence what happens to some businesses. They get to the point where the interest rates are so high on debt that they go to less reputable places to get loans where the cost will be less because there is a need to move the money from an illegitimate origin to a legitimate origin. Quit your grinning like that, okay? You know exactly what I'm talking about, don't you? And I mean, it's not one person. I mean, this is businesses do this all the time. In a way, a lot of the companies, when I was a consultant, they couldn't go to banks because the banks would have, first of all, either said absolutely not, or they would have charged them insane interest rates. So the only way we could do it was to find alternatives for making rain for them. Alternatives that would still charge them a lot, but would be willing to play, and in exchange for the providing money that needed a home that was more reputable than the home that it had originally been born in. And I'll leave it at that. I really should delete these podcasts. Yes. Must you be so blunt about it? Yes. Yes. As a matter of fact, I might have already told this. I don't know if I did or not. It was in the 1990s when I was a consultant. And most of the deals that came across my desk were just absolutely ludicrous. They were phony. They were based upon con men or myths or some lie. And the ones that were legit were usually something really legitimate, was kind of in quotation marks. But there was this one that was so stupid, and I thought, you know, this is bull crap because it can't happen. It's just the stupidest thing I had ever heard in my life. You know, I said, oh, go away, ew. And it was this group that I had encountered in Texas. And they contacted me and they said, we need to turn American dollars into Mexican pesos, which is as stupid as you can get. Why would you trade a beautiful American dollar for a trash at that time? And don't get me wrong, I love Mexico, except for when you die because you make the wrong person mad. But why would you do that? That's the stupidest thing. It was like the claims, well, we need the money to go find this stash of Nazi gold. Yeah, sure, right. Well, this one was like on that level. You want to exchange almost $1 billion into Mexican peso. No, that's like saying I want to turn a filet mignon steak into a turd sandwich. No. Well, it was about 4 years later that I was reading the newspapers that a very large, reputable accounting consulting firm based in New York City was being busted by the feds for doing exactly that. You see, because that was drug money that had been made on the streets of American cities, U.S. cities. It was in American dollars because the buyers were, of course, Americans paying American money, and they needed to convert it into pesos so they could put it into banks in Mexico. So that it actually turned out to be legit. That's money laundering on crack. But I'm talking about, in this case, much more legitimate laundering of money. And it happens all the time. A lot of the gangs that we might have thought were just nothing but violent thug gangs, they are actually incredibly sophisticated financial operations. I mean, they have everything from transportation and logistics people that move everything from money to people, drugs to money to people, on down through to investing in legitimate businesses, buying into IPOs, and then laundering the money through cycles like that, buying real estate at inflated prices. And I'm talking about everything from MS-13 on through to even staggeringly, the biker gangs from the 1960s and 70s have become incredibly sophisticated financial operations. And if you ever want to get into the world of busting those bad white-collar guys, the Treasury stock catches me every now and then and wants to know if I've got anyone who wants to be a Treasury agent. You get a badge and a gun, and you get to kick white-collar crime ass. The downside is that you can die very, very badly in that business. Watch the movie The Untouchables. It was about Treasury agents. True story about them. Sean Connery, Kevin Costner. So you live short life, but it's really interesting. And it's quite painful when you die, I should point out, as they show in that movie. But anyway, here is the setup. But the problem is that you can't just say, well, we've got all these earnings, we're going to do this project, and we'll just take it out of earnings because we've got plenty in earnings to do that. You can't do it that way. That's not how it works. And I am now must, to be a good professor, give you a demonstration, an important demonstration. This, you are a debt, a lender. You are the treasury chief in the company. And what is going to happen is that we need to finance a project. The project is going to cost a whole $1. Now, like I said, you have plenty of money. You have a dollar that you could do this with. But the problem here is that this company has a debt equity capital structure that is 25% debt and 75% equity. The capital project is going to cost $1. Now, I'd like to have my two volunteers please come out in the hall with me. We'll be back in just a jiffy. Your beard. This one's your horse head. I'm going to bring you in first. This is a farmer who needs to buy two horses. We are the two horses. I'm blacking out. You need a dollar. But you go over to your treasury person and reach for that $1 bill. And go ahead and reach for it. Now smack his hand. Because you would blow the debt equity capital structure, the optimal capital structure, if you gave him a dollar. You give him 75 cents. And you get from her the debt, the lender, 25 cents. Now you have maintained the optimal capital structure.
God, my breath is bad.
And now you can buy the horses. That horse is 75 cents, and I am 25 cents. And we can proceed with the project knowing, and he can proceed with the project knowing that he has maintained the optimal capital structure of the firm, and he has a new project underway that, bring your nose up, that is two horses. And a farmer. And the only remaining question that we have in this entire do you know how hard it is to see out of nostrils? The only question remaining is why she gets 75 cents and I get only 25 cents. Do you know why? Because I am a quarter horse.
Laugh, damn it, I'm breathing bad. There's your damn
story. Yes. I thank you. Yes.
Now you're looking. Yeah.
And I can guarantee you will never forget optimal capital structure again as long as you live. The last thing I'm going to do is I'm going to give you a quiz here, and then that's all I have for you today. I thank you.